Donald Trump is going to do absolutely nothing for the pro-life cause. That's the reality. Theology and life collide. We're going to be discussing anything and everything that you'll be facing in the world today after the sermon. My name is Jeremy Lundmark, and you're listening to episode number 61. Want to kick things off with a quick appetizer, and then we'll close this episode out with a brief discussion of the second presidential debate, which took place this past Sunday. What I want to do first, though, for our appetizer is, I forgot to do this in episode 60, Jerome Danner tweeted a question after the sermon, and this was his question. Why should we share the gospel with our children? Was it really meant to be passed down? And I think the answer to that question is, it's an obvious one. Yes, the gospel is meant to be shared to the uttermost parts of the world and to the utmost to our children. I think a better question that goes along with that, the obvious yes to his question, is how do we go about doing that? And I'm fascinated by the different ways in which different denominations handle this. If you come from a Baptist denomination, you're going to approach preaching the gospel to your children probably a little bit differently than a church that, like a Presbyterian church, that handles it through catechism and things like that, where you teach kids the gospel that way with the assumption that they'll be brought into the covenant, where as Baptists, independent Baptists, as opposed to like Reformed Baptists, who would probably follow the same strategy as the Presbyterians, they're going to treat their children as unregenerate and preach the gospel to them. And so there's a lot of different ways in which I've heard of people approaching this. I know one pastor that I knew, he purchased the Bible on audio and played it to his kids. We do that with our kids as well. He did it before they went to bed. We just sort of throw it in from time to time in the evenings to let them listen to it. Another way to do it is just bringing them to a church and engaging them in conversation. I actually noticed in connection with this question, Lex Lutheran, who we've had on the show before, tweeted out that he has his children write down questions during the sermon. So there's a lot of different ways in which you can evangelize your kids, but in the question whether or not we should, I think the obvious answer to that, first of all, is we should, just because the gospel by its very nature is meant to be preached to the uttermost parts of the world. Jesus had a great level of compassion for children and wanted to welcome them to himself and to the gospel. But also the scriptures are pretty clear about the responsibility of parents to raise their children in the fear and admonition of the Lord. This is pretty well laid out in the Old Testament, and I think it's very clear that we're supposed to be training our children morning, evening, all the time, and how they should live and walk and act in this world. And a part of that is preaching the gospel to them at any moment. And, you know, in order to put this in perspective, I think a lot of people, when they think of evangelizing or passing the gospel on, they go back to these moments in their training with Sunday school or Bible college where they were taught how to preach the gospel or share the gospel with a friend. I think it's a little bit different than that with your own family and with your own kids, because you live with them and you walk with them. And I think if you're smart, rather than having an assigned Bible time when you study the Bible, or, you know, even like I mentioned before, playing the audio tapes, I think letting life reveal the gospel is the best way to do that. And what I mean by that, I don't mean that in a superficial, mystical way, but when life happens, you can show Christ's redeeming principles in the world. For example, you make a huge mistake. Let's say, you know, I've got two kids. This happens fairly regularly. One gets blamed for something when the other one is responsible for what happened. You know, you punish the other kid, and then you find out later that maybe you punished the wrong child. This is a great opportunity to say, look, I'm unjust. I don't know everything. God does know everything, and I was wrong. So you have an opportunity here, first of all, to distinguish how you are different from God as a judge, and you have an opportunity to demonstrate repentance to your children. So early on, this can be very effective. You know, my kids, my oldest child is 8, so we haven't gotten to the point where it's academic. But the things that you learned in your evangelism class about sharing your testimony, a lot of that goes out the window. And if you take a more of a discipleship approach to evangelism anyway, you'll set that stuff aside. I don't think you need to, you know, go all 4 spiritual laws on your children. But I do think that when the opportunity arises, we have to demonstrate to our kids what it means to be a follower of Christ, what it means to be a part of a covenant community, and what is the gospel. And we see that every day. Christ is constantly putting us in situations and scenarios where this bears itself out. We have to be intentional as parents to identify those things and recognize our kids need to know what those things mean. And you never know when it's going to happen. I wrote a post, I guess it was 2 years ago, called Lollipop Shadows, where my daughter discovered that not only did she have a shadow, but her lollipop did too. And it sort of blew her mind. And these are opportunities to identify beauty and recognize that God is the creator of this. And it seems so simple, but we have to remember as parents that our kids are experiencing everything for the first time a lot of the times. And in knowing that, we have to have an excitement and a passion for all the things that we've gotten used to with, quote unquote, our understanding of God. And I think it's one of the beautiful things about raising kids is you do get the opportunity to watch them experience it for the first time. And, you know, the Christian walk can get mundane, but when you're doing this, whether it's with your own children or with disciples, you get to see them go, oh, you get to see the light click on. I've once described it as, you know, playing with a Rubik's Cube and finally figuring out how it works. I've never figured out how a Rubik's Cube worked, but I think that's a comparable illustration. You know, I can remember teaching a child in children's church at the church where I was pastoring, and he had been memorizing verses in the home. You know, he had memorized John 3:16, and on this particular day, I had a whole lesson planned out, and I showed them how to find a book of the Bible. And then it sort of clicked for him that, wait, so John 3:16 will take me to this verse that I've memorized. He had memorized the reference, but didn't understand how references worked. And so just by showing him where the books of the Bible were and where the index in the Bible was, all of a sudden it opened up this, it seemed so simple, but to him it was like, wow, my parents have been teaching me these verses, and now I can make this connection to this Bible that they hold so dearly. So it's little things like that that I think is how we pass on the scriptures early on. And then I don't feel adequate to recommend anything for people with kids who are 12, 13, preteen, whatever, in their tweens and on. That is something I have yet to experience, but I think you can lay that proper foundation early on and build from that. And ultimately, I think kids will find their way into understanding the regular routine of church. And I think that continues throughout life, just as it does with our fellowship with one another. As their theology develops, you get to walk them through that process. But definitely, we need to be passing the gospel on to our kids. What that means in each situation might be different, but I do think that that is one of our highest callings as parents, to preach the gospel to our children and to see them become committed to the faith that we hold so dear. Now I want to turn my attention to last night's presidential debate. You might not be listening to this the day after the debate, but I'm recording it the day after the debate, and I want to go over a couple of things. I don't want to get too detailed, and really, you can't get too detailed with what went down here on this debate, the second presidential debate. It was a town hall debate, which is where, you know, some audience members get to take questions. But man, I got to tell you, just before I get into this subject, I was reading a lot of articles from CNN leading up to this particular debate, and it seemed pretty obvious to me, although they went out of their way to suggest that the timing had nothing to do with where we're at in the election cycle or the fact that, you know, our guys and gal are going to be hosting this next debate. But man, they really went out of their way to smear Trump on the his what they would call misogyny. And it is misogyny, but his disrespect of women and demeaning of women. They went all hands on deck for this. And if you paid any attention to CNN leading up to the debate, it was incredible the amount of work that was done to document the amount of words and recordings and things that Donald Trump has said, vulgar things, lewd things, nothing that anybody, I hope, as a Christian would want to defend, and nothing that I'm going to quote here on this podcast, but just things that would just make your hair stand up on the back of your neck, just awful things about women. And that was their strategy. They went into this debate with the plan to question Donald Trump on this. And I think that's fine. I think they have every right to do that. I do think it's wildly imbalanced, though, for them not to bring up the past on Hillary. And I'm going to get into how this played out at the beginning of the debate. But I just wanted to point out that if you paid much attention to CNN's website leading up to, I don't watch CNN, but when I'm at work, CNN and Fox News are there. And I was just curious. Fox News was playing off Donald Trump's, you know, comments from 2005 is a little bit underwater, but man, they were just crude with it. They put it out there, and I think that's a good thing. I think that's a responsibility that they have, but it was very one-sided, and you could tell that they were going after Trump all week long. I mean, they dug up old, like 17 years worth of his visits to Howard Stern, and I told a friend of mine, it was like dissertation-level investigation on Donald Trump's disrespect towards women, which sadly came up with a lot of stuff. I think probably the most surprising thing to me is that people were surprised by this. We know who Donald Trump was. I tweeted out probably middle of last week that there's breaking news. Republicans are finally discovering that Donald Trump is the man they thought he was before they endorsed him. They knew what they were getting into. I think they were just shocked to see it driven home the way that it was and so crassly displayed in such a short period of time. I mean, it was awful what he said. I'm not going to get into his comments because there's certainly plenty of that out there, but it was clear to me that CNN had a script to go by, and Anderson Cooper and his counterpart, I don't know her name, they had a plan, they had a script, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute, but let's talk about the content of the debate first. The first 30 minutes of the debate or so were spent on these comments that CNN and company were looking to drill down on. Donald Trump didn't deny that he said these things or had said these things. The one thing that was in question that he never said one way or the other, I mean, he might have toward the end of their grilling him, but they were asking him if the words that he said, the things he said that were recorded over these last, you know, 10, 15 years, were they representative of who he was, or was he just bragging, but it wasn't true? And he seemed to really, the easy answer to that would have been no. I mean, he's certainly acquainted with lying, but he didn't seem to want to just come out and say, no, it's not true, I was just saying that. He was preferring to turn the attention, first of all, I think he did a great job. Let me just say this. I think it was the first 17 to 20 minutes, he did not respond with any attack on Secretary Clinton. He did not respond with anything regarding Bill Clinton's past initially. But it was the debate moderators who sort of coaxed him into this. And I want to talk about that towards the end of my analysis. But, you know, the debate moderators, they were clearly, and I'm going to show examples of this a little bit later, they were clearly like frustrated when either the audience or Donald Trump took them off course of where they wanted to go. And this was prominently on display at the beginning because they spent this 15, 20 minutes on this question going back and forth about, I mean, the woman's question, the first question was a question from the audience. Her question had to do with substance and let's get away from the attack stuff. And it really just devolved into a conversation about Trump's past. And ultimately, there was another question thrown in there, which was unnecessary. It didn't need to be thrown in there, but it followed the script. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But, you know, it seemed to me that the debate moderators were getting so frustrated with Trump in the audience when what they expected to happen didn't happen. It wasn't a frustration with interruption, and there was that. There were times when the debate moderators, even with Hillary Clinton towards the end, they would cut her off and stop her. Trump complained during the debate that they would let her go on for a full minute afterwards, and they were cutting him off right at the two-minute mark. Whether that's true or not, I'm not going to sit there with a timer or a stopwatch, but Trump at one point was basically pointing to the moderators, giving them hand signals like, hey, she's done, you're supposed to stop her. And he was getting frustrated with that. He felt like he was being treated unfairly. But all in all, I think if you look at this debate, Not a whole lot of content was brought up. That's not surprising to me. It's no different than the other debate that we saw in that respect. But I do think if we're going to talk about who won, and I use that term loosely because I don't think there's a winner or a loser in this situation because of just the content that's being thrown out there or the lack thereof. But in terms of the punchy lines and audience reaction, I think you have to give the night to Trump. Trump did very good. I think he handled himself a lot better longer, but he did start to go into his ranting ways toward the end. I think in the last debate, it took him about 10 minutes. In this debate, it took him about 30 minutes. And frankly, I think that that's what they were trying to get out of him. So I think if I were going to compare Trump from the previous debate to this one, I think he did a lot better in handling himself just in terms of his demeanor. He still does not know how to answer a question directly, and that seemed to frustrate the moderators too. And Trump confused their frustration with his inability to answer a direct question with trying to control the debate too. So they were clearly at times trying to get a specific response from him, but then there were other times where he really just needed to answer the question and he got bogged down talking about all the bad things Hillary's done in her past. And, you know, there's a place and a time for that, particularly when Hillary came out swinging along with the debate moderators. There was a point where he said, oh, okay, it's going to be 3-on-1. And he's right. It really did come off that way. And I think the moderators did try to respond to that by looking at how they were doing things and be a little bit more balanced towards the end. Some people may disagree with me on that, but I think early on it was pretty clear how this was playing out. But I think in terms of, you know, who delivered the punchiest lines and who controlled themselves better, I have to give it to Trump, certainly his most improved. Particularly, I think what gave him the edge was, whether you agree or not with his line when Hillary Clinton basically said, I'm just glad that somebody with your temperament wasn't in charge of the laws. He responded very quickly by saying, yeah, because you'd be in jail. The crowd erupted. They loved it. There were a couple times where the crowd got very excited about what Trump was saying, and the debate moderators were frustrated with them. Again, I'm coming back to that. But I have to say, if I were to compare these two debates, I gave the last debate to Hillary. She controlled herself all the way through. In this debate, she did a good job of answering the questions directly, and she controlled herself. But I think her control, to me anyway, and this is just an opinion, it came off as an inability to defend herself. She was on the line with that in the last debate, but Trump buried himself. I don't think he did that this time. He attacked her strategically and was less obtrusive than he was in the last debate. He certainly did go back to the interrupting of her, which is very frustrating. He does need to learn. He needs to learn two things. One, once he's delivered a punchline, he needs to just walk away. There wasn't one moment in this debate where Donald Trump sat down. And if you've ever seen a town hall debate, usually the opponent sits down. Hillary did that. She followed what would be considered the unspoken rule of when you're not talking, you sit down. He was pacing around like a caged lion for the entire debate, just waiting to interrupt her and say things he didn't need to say. And honestly, he will say what he wants to say, and then he repeats it over and over. I tweeted out a couple of things. When he starts repeating his adjectives and starts making up words that don't exist, that's like 3 seconds before that, he should just close his statement. He doesn't seem to know how to do that. And I told a friend on Facebook, I said, it seems to me like he's actually an insecure person, and he has to keep going to justify his own existence because he doesn't have anything to prove to us. Like, once you've delivered your punchline and you've made your point, sit down, right? Like turn the mic off. And I do think, by the way, the debate moderator should have the ability to close down the mic so that they can't talk. That would just solve this whole problem. Just shut the mic down. Now people would get mad about that too, because then you would have arguments that the moderators are trying to control the debate. But why not just have a 2-minute timer that cuts them off? You know, sorry, you're silenced now. Next question to the other person. You just keep rambling. But I mean, there's times where Donald Trump, I think the word was tremendously. He said like, our national debt is tremendously, it's tremendous. It's tremendously tremendous or something like that. And it's like, you're repeating your adjectives, dude. Like, at that point, you just need to stop. And there's another point where he said, I'm not unproud of that, or I'm unproud of that, or something like that. I'm like, that's not a word. And I think he said rejiggered at one point. And it's like, okay, when you get to that point where you're reaching for a word to say and you can't think of it, stop. You know, and there's a great video clip going out there right now on Facebook. Maybe I'll share this. I don't know if I can find it. I saw it and I laughed hilariously. When he is done with a thought, and maybe I noticed this because I'm a speaker myself, he takes a deep breath, and people are calling it the sniffles. But when he runs out of a line of reasoning, he goes, and he catches his breath. And actually, he needs to get a drink of water and sit down, but he can't stop himself. He feels like he has to keep going and going and going. It's almost like the fact that he's run out of thoughts makes him feel like he needs to put more thoughts out there, and he needs to just stop. Just stop, man. And there were so many points in this debate where he could have delivered his line and sat down. Just sat down. And it would have come off so beautifully. Now, he didn't do that, so he didn't come off too much of a winner, but there were enough of these times where it was obvious that CNN was trying to script this debate and the audience wasn't going along with it because of what Trump was saying, that I felt like he sort of won the day. When I look at Hillary, though, I do think that she did come off more patient than him. I'm still growing very tired of her go to my fact checker on my website. I mean, to me, it looks like when she has no answer for Trump and when he's really gotten under her skin, that's all she's got left. Just go to my fact checker. Just go to my fact checker. Well, when you're president and a world leader is bearing down on you, you can't say, well, go to my fact checker. That's really, it's just annoying. You be the fact checker. We're electing you to be president, not your fact checker or your website. As important as web hits must be to her, nobody wants to read your fact checker. You need to fact check him right there in the debate. And that's why you're on national television. You're running for president. You should know this stuff. So all in all, I mean, Hillary did a good job answering the questions. I think she tried to, even though both of them continued to give answers that are wildly general, like, how do you plan to fix X? Well, X needs to be fixed, and Hillary is not going to fix X, and I'm going to do a great job with it. Okay, but that's not an answer. And both of them do that, right? They both come off with these answers that are non-specific so that it sounds like they're going to do great things, but they don't get any real detail in there. So in terms of general debate, it was pretty frustrating again, mostly for entertainment purposes, and it wasn't very entertaining at that. Now, before I get to where I saw the debate moderator sort of getting frustrated with the non-compliance with their script, I did want to point out that towards the end of the debate, in fact, I think it was the last question, the closing question is one that I actually posed on Facebook. I forget the name of the guy. I think his last name was Becker. He came out with a question that was basically, name one thing about your opponent that you like. And because of the tenor of this year's presidential election, the crowd erupted with laughter. I think Twitter basically blew up. It was like, wow, that was a great question. And it is a good question. I actually recommended that the question be, name five things that your opponent has done. But I was pleased to see this question because it was one that I had thought of and I had wished would get asked. And it did get asked. Now, he only asked for one thing. Hillary, I think a lot of people saw this as a dodge. You can look at it both ways because she didn't say something admirable about Donald. She said, I admire his kids. If you take that to the fact that he is a good parent and raised good kids, then, you know, that's good. And he sort of took it that way. He's like, well, I'm going to take that as a compliment, whether or not you meant it as one. And it's hard to see whether or not Hillary meant it as one or not. And then Donald Trump came back and said, I admire her tenacity. She never quits. So, and I think that's a good response from him. It respects something about her, a character quality about her, without saying anything about policies or anything like that. So, you know, all in all, the debate was a disaster again. I think Trump responded well. It'll be interesting to see how the third debate goes. I'm wondering if Donald Trump will ever learn to control himself, and I'm wondering if Hillary is going to continue to throw out her fact-checker line after about 45 minutes of a debate that is 90 minutes long. But we'll see about that. But both of them, I think, did pretty well. In terms of how this debate cycle has gone. But overall, we didn't get a whole lot of content. I was very frustrated with it. Now I want to talk about my biggest distraction from this debate, and I guess it's easy to be critical of the debate moderators, but let me say something positive before I get into the negative. The debate moderators at least were engaged in this particular debate, where they were sparring with the candidates to stop when it was time to stop. I didn't feel like the last debate moderator, I think his name was Lester Holt, I could be wrong about that name, but the last debate moderator was basically non-existent. He basically just let the candidates run over each other and didn't get anywhere with his questions or stopping the candidates from rambling on and on. In this particular debate, they were more engaged, but the way they were engaged was really peculiar. Now, I want to share some clips, and then I'll come back and sort of talk to you about what I'm seeing here. But before I share these clips, I just want you to listen to the response and the cadence with which they respond to both Donald Trump and the audience. And how it doesn't seem like they're really as concerned about the debate as they are about the direction the debate's going. And that's what bothered me the most about it. Plus, you know, it wasn't just the fact that it was weird, the timing was weird, but it's almost like they're using the audience to be their reason to stop the candidates, but then the audience stops complying with their whole idea of how this debate should go. And they try to make the audience feel bad because the audience is happy. It's just so weird. I mean, I'm going to share a clip of the opening remarks, which I thought were just like kind of like randomly condescending. And then I'm going to share a couple later instances where they interrupted and used the audience as their reason. And then I'm going to share a little bit of a point here where the audience erupts into applause and they try to use that same excuse on the audience. It's like, listen, audience, we're here for you. Stop applauding and stop enjoying yourself and stop reacting to these candidates. So here's some clips of them like correcting the audience and using the audience as their leverage to silence the candidates.
We hope to get to as many questions as we can. So we've asked the audience here not to slow things down with any applause.
When Hillary brings up a point like that and she talks about words that I said 11 years ago, I think it's disgraceful, and I think she should be ashamed of herself, if you want to know the truth.
Can we please hold the applause? Secretary Clinton, you have 2 minutes.
Everything he just said is absolutely false, but I'm not surprised.
Really?
In the first debate,
I told people that
it would be impossible to be fact-checking Donald all the time. It's just awfully good that someone with the temperament of Donald Trump is not in charge of the law in our country.
Because you'd be in jail.
Secretary Clinton.
We want to remind the audience to please not talk out loud. Please do not applaud. You're just wasting time.
From the United States Congress.
We have to move on. Secretary Clinton, you can respond, and then we got to move on.
We want to give the audience a chance here.
You'd be put in jail, let alone after getting a subpoena from the United States Congress.
Secretary Clinton, you can respond, then we have to move on to an audience question.
So you can hear from those clips how the debate moderators were sort of using this, you know, we want to get to as many questions as possible line to quiet the candidates, and even at one point try to quiet the audience with that. But at the same time, one of the weirdest situations was right at the beginning when we really only needed to spend about 10 to 15 minutes, not even that long, on Trump's past remarks. And if they had gotten off this subject at that point, like they said they were going to do, I don't think Trump would have brought up Bill Clinton's indiscretions. But this was the weirdest point in the debate for me, because they're going to quiet Donald Trump using the excuse that we need to get on to a different topic. And then they stay on the topic. And here's what you have to understand. I'm going to share just a brief clip where they interrupt Donald Trump, then they move to the next question. But here's what you got to understand. They had already spent 17 minutes on this point, and they felt the need to silence Trump because he was going on too much about this point. Then they go to a question about the same point, which basically the point that they're talking about was his past conversation and, you know, his degradation of women, et cetera, et cetera. So the CNN host moderators stop Donald Trump from saying what he needs to say, whether it's because it was too much of an attack on Hillary Clinton or it's not in line with the script they're trying to go with. They're trying to bring it back to make Donald Trump look bad, and he was starting to get under Hillary Clinton's skin. So they try to turn the tails, but they don't. They go back to a question about the same subject. So listen to this.
When she was a United States Senator, she campaigned where the
Mr. Trump, I want to get to audience questions and online questions.
So she's allowed to do that, but I'm not allowed to respond.
You're going to get to respond right now.
That sounds fair.
This tape is generating intense interest. In just 48 hours, it's become the single most talked about story of the entire 2016 election on Facebook, with millions and millions of people discussing it on the social network. As we said a moment ago, we do want to bring in questions from voters around the country via social media. And our first stays on this topic. Jeff from Ohio asks on Facebook, Trump says the campaign has changed him. When did that happen?
So for me, sitting there watching the debate, I was actually glad that they were going to get off that subject matter at this point. When I heard them stop him, I was like, good. You know, Donald Trump doesn't need to get into Bill Clinton's past discretions and bring Hillary into this. We don't need to continue this mud throwing. And then they go right back into it. And it was at that point in the debate where I was like, you know what? They deserve everything they're going to get. They're begging Donald Trump to go after Clinton's indiscretions. And Donald Trump, quote unquote, takes the bait, but I wouldn't say it in sort of a negative term. They asked for it. They were begging him to go there. And I think he did it in a way that was respectful as that topic can be. I think he did a fantastic job in delivering. He waited. It almost seemed like he wasn't planning to go there. It's almost like on the public debate stage, he didn't want to go there, but they just kept pressing and pressing and pressing. And there was one point where I was like, you know what? Do it. Do it. They deserve it. They're asking for it. So it's almost like they wanted that to be brought up. Who knows what they were thinking by continuing that line of questioning, but they wanted it. And ultimately, we ended up with like 30 to 35 minutes on that one subject of a 90-minute presidential debate talking about Donald Trump's past conversations about women. Now, listen, I definitely agree that that's a subject matter worth talking about. Character does matter. But there's a difference between bringing up character and the importance of that in a debate to discuss about how that might apply to how he would deal with world leaders and how he would use his power towards women. But at the same time, it's like that did not need to be 90 minutes of the debate. That's something where you touch on it. You have each candidate talk about it, give their piece on it. And then move on to policy, move on to how they're going to handle world affairs and economics. And there's so many things to talk about. But we're going to spend 30 minutes on this? It was really sad. Now, the last thing I want to mention here is I thought there were two very big missed opportunities for Donald Trump. I'm going to share clips of both of them. There were two points in this debate where I was just sitting there going, oh, Hillary Clinton just set him up for this. And the first one came when she had demanded that he give an apology, and he started to go down this long rant of things that she needs to apologize for. She was talking about his inability to apologize, even though he had apologized just this past week. She's going on and on about how badly he needs to apologize. He's never apologized to this person. He responds by that, and there's this one point where he says, you know who I really think you need to apologize to? And in my mind, as I'm watching the debate, I'm like, you need to say something about Benghazi right now. It would have been a perfect moment for him to bring up a negative side about Hillary Clinton that his entire base and a lot of the American people are uncomfortable with, something she had done that ended the lives of American people overseas, and he totally missed it. He went to the emails, and I was like, no, he should have ended that with a high level of support for our military and honored those men who lost their lives and made Hillary Clinton out to be the person who was responsible for that and say they deserve your apology. Their families deserve your apology. We believe no man is supposed to be left behind. You left them behind. Oh, it was set up so perfectly for him to do that. And he went to the emails. Now, later on in the debate, he comes back to Benghazi. I think it was like about an hour into the debate. He does bring up Benghazi. It's too late. It didn't fit. And here I am sitting here thinking, man, she set him up so perfectly for this. And he didn't do it. So let me share this clip with you. And I'll stop it at the point where I think he should have said Benghazi. And then I'll share the rest of the clip with you in terms of 30,000 emails. But it's like, man, you should have said Benghazi. You should have brought up those families. You should have had the names of those people on your tongue ready to go at this moment. He didn't have it. Here's the clip.
But when you talk about apology, I think the one that you should really be apologizing for and the thing that you should be apologizing for are the 33,000 emails that you deleted and that you acid washed.
Right here, right at this point, is when I would have wanted him to bring up Benghazi, but he didn't do it. Instead, he goes down the email track and wants to bring up the 30,000 emails. And it was a sad attack. It was sort of like the pinnacle and the 30,000 emails. It's like, okay, you know, there's a time and a place to talk about the emails that she scrubbed. Great. This wasn't it. You really could have honored the military, set yourself up as a great commander in chief, made her look like a terrible commander in chief, made your honor of veterans and military men and military servicemen. It would have been fantastic, but he missed that opportunity. Now, another missed opportunity that I thought was just sort of, this is one I completely expected, but it was so obvious. If you had had a truly, genuinely pro-life candidate on the stage, they would have nailed Hillary Clinton on this point and would have been proud about their pro-life stance and would have presented that pro-life stance. But instead, Hillary, basically they're talking about what types of judges you're going to appoint. And Hillary says some sort of nonsense about somebody who knows about the world and more general comments. And then she also takes some jabs at Donald Trump about the fact that he might elect Supreme Court justices who will be pro-life, who will look to overturn Roe versus Wade, etc. And to me, this is just like, this is a point that evangelical Christians across the country, especially after your ridiculously disgusting remarks, are looking for you to go. This is the thin string that anybody that I know who is still in support of Trump after last week, this is the one fabric that is left for them. That's their one argument. It can't be morality. It can't be his perceived Christianity. It's not his perceived repentance. It's not the fact that someday he'll become presidential. At this point, nobody expects any of those things to happen, but we'll get a pro-life Supreme Court justice. And rather than say anything about overturning Roe versus Wade, rather than say anything about how he might defund Planned Parenthood, or how he would elect Supreme Court justices who would look to that end, he just talks about Justice Scalia. Now, I understand that pro-lifers who are itching for something are sitting there going, well, that counts, because, you know, Justice Scalia was pro-life. But for somebody who is genuinely pro-life and actually sees the child as a human being, it would have been very easy to take a shot at Hillary Clinton. And it would have been fantastic to play off of this, because this whole debate has been talking about how horrible Donald Trump is towards women. This would have been a fantastic point to say, well, at least there's some women I'm willing to protect, and those are the ones in the womb. It's sad that you're not one of those women. I want to do that. I think every life matters. But again, he doesn't take this opportunity to be proud of this stance. Now, one person on Twitter said, you know, this is a general election. I'm like, yeah, but still, the only threat, he's got to know this, that the only thread that's keeping anybody who's an evangelical on his little Trump train is that one thing. And I guess if you're so delusional that you're just begging for the Republican Party to someday, some way, hopefully bring in this savior who will sit on the bench and will overturn Roe v. Wade, then I guess you could see that as a pro-life statement. But here's the reality. Donald Trump is going to do absolutely nothing for the pro-life cause. That's the reality. He will say he's going to do a lot because he needs your vote, but he's not going to do anything. And you say, well, how do you know that? How can you predict that? I'll tell you how. There have been men who have been elected president as Republicans in the last 20, 30, 40 years who stood on the pro-life platform and who were actually pro-life. Like, they were personally pro-life. They actually believed it for themselves. We have no reason to believe that Donald Trump is such, considering his past. But people who were consistently pro-life throughout their life, president, nothing changed. Nothing changed. So when Donald Trump gets up there and says he's going to elect somebody who's like Justice Scalia, what's going to change? We'll have another judge like Scalia? Scalia didn't overturn Roe versus Wade. I mean, I'm happy for Justice Scalia. I liked him a lot. I appreciated him. But replacing him with someone just like him, nothing changed in abortion in the last 40 years. So how is that a reason to vote for Donald Trump? But here's the thing. With that one single strand being the last thing that evangelicals are still holding on to, he said nothing about it. Nothing. Especially even in the wake of his sickeningly vile comments about women, he does nothing or very little at this point to try to give those people who, after that point, were saying, ugh, you know, I'm a Christian, I was going to vote for you. I've been saying this stuff's all in the past, but now, you know, this is too much for me. The one thing that they're going to hold on to is the Supreme Court justice, and he barely gives them anything to hope for. So for me, this was a huge missed opportunity. I think he could have come off strong here and defended the pro-life position and done so in a way that would have appealed to not only conservative Christian voters, but liberal Christian voters, would have appealed to them at least to say, look, I do have some semblance of morality in me, and this is where it lands, you know. But we didn't get that. And to me, it was just more of the same from a Republican nominee. We're not going to get anything from them. And he's not just changing his message for the general election. He's getting ready to be president, and that's how he's going to be going forward. I do know this. If Mike Pence had been in this debate, he would have said something. Mike Pence is actually pro-life. He's genuinely pro-life. He believes that a child in the womb is a person. And so when Hillary Clinton used that as some sort of disgrace or a shame, he would have been proud to respond and say, look, I'm not just pro-life. I'm proud to be pro-life. And, you know, to me, the concern is I don't think he wanted to say anything about it because he's ashamed of it. I, for one, am not ashamed of being pro-life. And nobody who is pro-life should be ashamed of it, because it, to take the opposite position is to undermine millions of people every single year. And it's disgusting, and it's sick. And to me, that's a platform you can stand on, to say that you want to protect every life, that you're there for every American. This is stuff that candidates say all the time. I mean, there's one point in this debate where Hillary Clinton was like, oh, I want to be the president for every American. Listen, sunshine, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen as long as you're killing hundreds of thousands of millions and supporting the killing of them and selling off their body parts and supporting the organization that does. It's not going to happen. You're not going to be my president. And you're not going to be anybody who's genuinely pro-life's president. Even if you're elected president, we're not going to side with you. You're not going to be our president. You're not going to be on our side. It's not going to happen. So to me, that was a missed opportunity. I think you can take that pro-life stance without coming off the wrong way. I think you can be, you can turn that into a stance that all Americans can agree with. You know, that I don't just believe that some lives matter. I believe that all lives matter. I mean, it just could have been so many ways you can take that and win with it, and Donald Trump missed it altogether. So while I think he did better in this debate, and I think he did better than Hillary Clinton in this debate, overall, again, a substanceless debate, 30 minutes roughly spent on sexual escapades of him and Bill Clinton, and then the rest was just bickering and bantering back and forth, and she's not telling the truth, he's not telling the truth. Pretty sad stuff. The state of affairs is not good. So with that said, who are you going to vote for? Well, I don't have an answer to that question yet. I'm actually considering not voting at all. We just put together a Theology Mixer radio program. Scott McCauzy, host of Christian Devotion Speak Up. Matt Whitman was one of our guests. He does the 10-Minute Bible Hour, and his YouTube channel, Worst Christian Ever, has some really great clips on it. And then Elijah Thompson of the Fetal Position Podcast. We got together yesterday and did a Theology Mixer radio program just about the candidates, and we brought Gary Johnson in as an idea and whether or not it's okay to vote for a third party in general. I'm not sure who I'm going to vote for. I'm 100% sure I'm not voting for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. I just don't know who I am going to vote for. And so I would encourage you to check out Theology Mixer Radio. That episode should be dropping later this week, and that'll get you some more substance in terms of what candidates you can vote for and how, as a Christian, you can vote and still keep your conscience clear this election. Before the election comes, I will let you know who I'm voting for. I'm torn. Right now, I'm leaning towards Daryl Castle just because, well, we talk about this a little bit in our Theology Mixer radio program, but I want to vote against the two-party system, so I'm definitely going to vote third party. But I'm still not sure what third party I'm going to vote for. I wanted to vote for the Libertarian candidate, but I'm so against so much of what Gary Johnson believes that I don't think I can bring myself to do that either. So Daryl Castle is likely to get my vote. I haven't firmly decided that, and I'm not even sure if he is going to be on the ballot here in Pennsylvania. I'm still waiting to hear about that for sure. So I'm not sure who I'm voting for. Curious who you're voting for. Tweet at me. I'd be curious to know if you've made your decision. One last thing I want to do before we close out episode number 61 is I want to announce the winner. This has been a two-episode giveaway for J.C. Ryle's Practical Religion. I've been asking folks to tweet out either a picture or a comment about what they're doing. Our winner this week is Chris Ragsdale. Appreciate you tweeting out what you were doing after the sermon. Good stuff, by the way. You're studying. That's good stuff. So I'll be sending this out to you. I'll connect with him and thinking about what my next giveaway is going to be. I don't have one for this week. I'll get you one here in the next week. We may have an episode disturbance next week just because I'm going to be out of town next week going over to my parents' house again. I was there a couple weeks ago. We're going to be getting a car from them, but I'm also going to be helping my dad do some brakes. He's got three vehicles that have brakes that need to be done. Well, it's my dad and my sister, so we got a bunch of brakes to do, and I'm going to help him with that. So I will be out of town next week. If I find a way to get an episode out while I'm there, I will do that, but be looking for an episode at least 2 weeks from now, if not sooner, and be looking for Theology Mixer Radio. I'll be sure to tweet that out with the After the Sermon Facebook page and Twitter account. So be looking for those things. This concludes episode number 61 of After the Sermon. As always, I thank you for using up your time, your data, your hard drive space, whatever, to listen to this program. Share intentionally. There's a lot in here about the presidential debate and a great conversation here at the beginning about raising your children in the fear and admonition of the Lord. So encourage you to share this with folks intentionally, give them a direct message, send them a message through Facebook, however you want to do that. And like I always say, give them timestamps. I think people appreciate that. And don't forget to tweet out what you're doing after the sermon. I'm trying to jump on Twitter and ask people what they are doing both Wednesday night and Sunday afternoon. I think I missed it this past Sunday afternoon, but do share with me what you're doing after the sermon. And as always, folks, I may see you next week, but if not then, the following week after the sermon.